The ballroom at Lord Marchfield's country seat was full of light and noise, and Vivienne stood at the edge of it like a girl standing at the edge of a pond she did not plan to enter. Candles burned in tall silver holders along every wall, and the smell of melted wax mixed with the sweeter smell of hothouse roses that someone had cut and placed in great white bowls on every table. The floor was polished so bright she could see the hem of her gown move when she breathed. The gown itself was pale green silk, soft as water, but it was not new. It had been new 5 years ago, when her older sister Petra had worn it to her first season in London. Now the silk was thin at the elbows, and the lace at the wrist had been mended twice. And Vivienne knew every stitch, because she had done the mending herself. She did not mind, or she told herself she did not mind. The gown still fit, and she had taken the high lace collar off and replaced it with a simple ribbon the colour of cream, and in the candlelight the green looked almost like the colour of new spring leaves. Her mother had told her 3 times in the carriage that no one would notice. Her sister Petra, riding across from her in a gown of bright rose pink that had been made that very month in London, had said nothing at all, only looked out the carriage window, and smiled at her own reflection in the dark glass. Vivienne held a small painted fan in her right hand and a glass of warm lemon water in her left, and she stood near a tall potted orange tree, because the tree partly hid her from the room. From here she could see the dancers turn under the chandeliers and hear the violins, and she could also see her sister in the middle of a group of laughing young women, the rose-pink gown bright as a flag among them. Petra was laughing in the way Petra always laughed at parties, with her head tipped back and her white throat showing. 3 young gentlemen stood near her. None of them looked anywhere else. A small private routine kept Vivienne from feeling truly alone. She had done it for years at parties where she was overlooked. She counted the candles. She did not count them quickly. She started at the far left corner of the room and moved her eyes slowly along the wall. 1 candle, 2 candles, 3, and the soft yellow flames steadied her in the way other women were steadied by music. She had reached 17 candles when she felt the room change. She could not have said how she felt it. The music did not stop. The dancers did not stop. But the sound in the room dropped by a small amount, as if a heavy door had been closed somewhere far away, and the smell of the roses seemed sharper, and the people nearest the great double doors at the south end of the ballroom shifted in their places. A footman straightened his back. A young woman touched her hair. The host, Lord Marchfield, hurried across the floor with his hands held out. A man had come through the doors. He was not the tallest man in the room. He was not the most finely dressed. His coat was very dark, almost black, and his cravat was simple white linen, and there was no jewel anywhere on him except a plain gold ring on his smallest finger. He did not look around the room the way other guests looked around when they entered. He did not search for anyone. He came in as if he had already decided he did not need to be entertained. The Duke of Ashbourne whispered a woman to her right, and 3 other women whispered the same thing in different corners, and Vivienne understood at once that this was the man everyone had been waiting for. She had heard of him. Everyone had heard of him. He was said to be cold. He was said to have refused the daughter of an earl last spring without giving any reason at all. He was said to be looking for a wife and to be impossible to please. He was 31 years old and had inherited his title 6 years before, and he owned 3 estates and a great house in London that no one had been allowed inside for years. Vivienne watched him because everyone was watching him, and because she had nothing else to do behind her orange tree. She watched Lord Marchfield bow and welcome him and walk him toward the dancers. She watched 2 mothers pull their daughters closer to the path he would take. She watched her own mother, across the room, place 1 hand on Petra's elbow and turn her so the rose-pink gown would catch his eye. The Duke walked past Petra without looking at her. He walked past 3 other young women without looking at them. He did not look bored. He looked like a man who had work to do and was waiting for the part of the work he could not avoid. He took a glass of wine from a passing footman without thanking him. Then a moment later, when the footman had moved on, he turned his head slightly and said something to the footman's back, and the footman stopped and turned and bowed and looked pleased. Vivienne could not hear the words. She thought it was a thank you, said late but said. She lifted her glass of lemon water to her lips. The lemon was sharp, and the water was almost too warm to drink. She lowered the glass again and went back to counting candles. She had reached 23 when she felt the room change a second time, in a smaller and more private way, and she lifted her eyes. The Duke of Ashbourne was looking at her. He was standing perhaps 15 paces away, in the middle of a small group of people who were talking at him, without noticing that he was not listening. His glass of wine was halfway raised. His face did not move. But his eyes were on her, and they had been on her for long enough that the woman beside him had turned her head to see what he was looking at. Vivienne felt her own face grow warm. She lowered her eyes and counted the next candle, candle 24, and the next, candle 25. When she looked up again, he was still watching. He did not smile. He did not nod. He simply looked at her as if she were a page in a book he had not finished reading. She did the only thing she could think to do. She turned her face away and pretended to study a painting on the wall to her left. The painting was of a brown horse standing in a field. She had no opinion about the painting at all. She made herself look at it for the count of 10, and then 20, and when at last she allowed herself to glance back toward the place where the Duke had been standing, he was no longer there. He was walking across the room. He was walking toward her. She thought, very clearly and very calmly, that this could not be happening. She thought he must be walking toward the doors that opened onto the terrace, which were behind her and to her right. She turned her body slightly to make room for him to pass and lifted her glass again so that her hands would have something to do. The lemon water tasted of nothing now. He did not pass. He stopped directly in front of her, close enough that she could smell rain on his coat, although it had not rained that evening, and underneath that the warm smell of leather and something darker that she could not name, perhaps the smell of a fire that had been burning in another room some hours ago. "Miss Hartwell," he said. It was not a question. He said her name as if he had known it for some time and had only been waiting for a chance to use it. His voice was low and quiet, not loud enough to be heard by anyone more than 2 paces away. She made a small curtsy. She heard the music keep playing, and she heard her own heart, and she heard, behind her, the sudden silence of the women near the wall who had been talking and had now stopped. "Your Grace," she said. She did not say anything else. She had been taught what to say in such a moment, but the words had gone out of her head, and besides, she did not believe yet that the moment was real. She thought he might be about to ask after her father or her sister, or whether the orange tree behind her was in season. He said, "You have been counting the candles." She had not expected that. Her chin came up half an inch before she could stop it. She met his eyes properly for the first time. They were the color of weak tea, brown with a little gold in them, and they were not laughing. "I have, Your Grace," she said. "How many?" 27, before you crossed in front of me. I lost my place. I am sorry to have disturbed you. You are not, I think. The corner of his mouth moved. It was not a smile. It was the place where a smile might begin if he ever let it. "No," he said. "I am not." She did not know what to say to that. She lifted her glass, found it empty, and lowered it again. From the corner of her eye she could see her mother across the room, frozen in the act of speaking to another lady, staring. She could see Petra too. Petra had stopped laughing. "Will you dance with me, Miss Hartwell?" he said. "I do not think so, Your Grace." The silence in the small space between them was so complete that she could hear the small hissing sound a candle made when a drop of wax slid down its side. The Duke did not move. He did not look offended. He looked as if she had said something interesting that he wished to think about. "Why not?" he said. "Because everyone is watching. They were watching before. They will watch after." "Yes, but if I do not dance with you, they will lose interest faster." "You are sure of this?" "I am sure of it, Your Grace. I have spent some years watching how people watch." He looked at her for a long second. Then he set his own glass of wine on the small table beside the orange tree, and he held out his hand. palm up, in the old polite way. "Then walk with me," he said, "once around the room. We will both keep our dignity, and you may continue to count your candles as we go." She did not know why she put her hand on his. She would think about that moment for many days afterward, and she would not find a good reason. Perhaps it was because he had asked her to walk and not to dance. Perhaps it was because he had said her name as if it mattered. Perhaps it was only because the orange tree at her back was no longer hiding her, and walking forward was easier than standing still. His hand under hers was warm and very steady. They began to move along the edge of the room. 28, she said quietly, as they passed the next candle. 29. 30. You truly count them, he said. I told you I did. Most ladies would have lied. I am not most ladies, Your Grace, and you would not have believed me if I had said something pretty. No, he said, I would not have. They walked. He did not speak again for some time. She counted candles softly under her breath. The room watched them. She could feel her sister Petra's eyes on her back like the point of a needle. When they had gone half the length of the room, he said, "How long have you been wearing this gown?" She thought he meant tonight. Then she understood he meant the gown itself. She felt her face grow warm again, but she did not look down at the soft green silk. She looked straight ahead. 5 years, she said. It was my sister's first. I have remade the sleeves twice. It suits you better than it suited her. You did not see her in it, Your Grace. I have seen her in the gown she is wearing tonight. I am drawing a conclusion. She did not answer that. They walked. They passed candle 37 and 38 and 39. When they had nearly completed the circle of the room, he stopped walking. They were now close to where she had been standing before, near her orange tree, but slightly to one side, so that the orange tree no longer hid her at all. "Miss Hartwell," he said, "I will be at Marchfield for 3 more days. Will you allow me to call upon your family tomorrow afternoon?" She looked up at him. She did not know how to refuse him, and she was not entirely sure she wanted to. "You will have to ask my father, Your Grace." "I will ask your father. I am asking you first." The room was a soft roar of music and voices. Somewhere a young woman laughed too loud. Vivienne lifted her chin. "You may call, Your Grace," she said. "I cannot promise to be at home." This time the corner of his mouth did move. "Just a little. Fair enough," he said. He bowed over her hand, and he was gone, and she was standing alone again with an empty glass and a fan she had not opened all evening, and every single eye in the room was on her. And her sister Petra was walking toward her, across the polished floor in the rose-pink gown with her face quite white. The carriage ride home was very quiet. Vivienne sat with her hands folded in her lap and her eyes on the carriage lamp, which swung gently from side to side and made the inside of the carriage smell of warm oil. Her mother sat across from her and did not speak. Her father was riding ahead on horseback. Petra sat beside their mother, her rose-pink skirts spread carefully so they would not crease, her face turned toward the dark window. When they were perhaps a mile from home, Petra spoke. "I cannot think why he chose you," she said. She did not say it loudly. She said it in the same light voice she used to speak of the weather or a poor cup of tea. Their mother made a small sound that might have been a warning, but Petra did not look at their mother. She looked at Vivienne, and she smiled the small smile she had used when they were children and she had broken something and meant to blame Vivienne for it. "He must have mistaken you," Petra said. "He must have meant to walk to someone behind you, and you stepped into his path. That happens sometimes to girls who stand near doors." "I was not standing near a door," Vivienne said. "Near a tree, then, it is much the same thing. Someone tall and quiet and decorative, that one does not quite see." "Petra," their mother said. "It is only," Petra went on, as if she had not heard, "that I should hate for you to be hurt, dearest. He has called on no one all season. He will not call tomorrow. You will sit in the drawing room in that old gown and wait for him, and he will not come. And we will all have to be very kind to you about it. I only thought I would tell you now, so that you might prepare your face. The carriage went over a hole in the road, and the lamp swung harder. Vivienne did not answer. She looked at the lamp, and she thought of the Duke's hand under hers, very warm and very steady, and she thought of the way he had said her name as if he had been carrying it in his pocket for some weeks. But she also thought, because she was not a fool, that Petra might be right. He came at 3 the next afternoon. Vivienne was sitting in the drawing room with her mother and Petra, and she was wearing the gown she always wore in the afternoon, which was muslin with small blue flowers and was 3 years old. She had not changed her dress. She had decided, when she woke that morning, that if he came at all he must come to the girl who had stood behind the orange tree, and not to a different girl made up to impress him. When the footman announced him, Petra rose from her chair too quickly, and the small piece of needlework on her lap fell to the floor. Their mother rose more slowly, with her hand pressed to her bodice. Vivienne rose last of all. She was very calm. She had used up all her fright in the night. The Duke came in. He bowed to her mother first, properly. He bowed to Petra. He came to Vivienne last and took her hand and bowed over it. "Miss Hartwell," he said. "Your Grace," she said. He sat in the chair her mother offered him. He spoke politely about the weather. He praised her mother's drawing room. He asked Petra about her music, and Petra answered prettily and well, and her colour came back into her cheeks. He listened to her without ever looking quite away from where Vivienne sat in the window seat, with her hands in her lap. After perhaps 10 minutes, he said, "Mrs. Hartwell, I wonder if Miss Hartwell would walk with me in your garden. It is a fine afternoon." Her mother said yes before he had finished speaking. The garden was small. Their father was not a wealthy man, and the gardener came only twice a week, but the roses were doing well and the gravel path was clean. Vivienne walked beside the Duke with her hands clasped at her waist. He walked with his hands behind his back. They went slowly. "You did not change your gown," he said. "No, why not?" "Because if you came for the gown, I did not wish you to come." He nodded once, as if she had said something reasonable. The smell of the roses was very strong. A bee moved near her elbow, then away. "Your sister was at the ball last night," he said. "Yes, and the night before, at the assembly rooms, and the night before that, at the Greys' dinner. I have seen her 4 times this week. She is very accomplished." "She is. She has been placed in my way at every gathering for 7 days. Her mother has spoken to me twice. Lord Marchfield was instructed, before I arrived last night, to seat us together at supper." Vivienne did not know what to say. She watched the gravel under her shoes. "I was told a great deal about Miss Petra Hartwell before I ever saw her," he said. "I was told nothing at all about Miss Vivienne Hartwell. I was not even sure there was a Miss Vivienne Hartwell until last night." "My sister is the elder," Vivienne said. "It is right that she be presented first. It is not right," he said, "if it means that the other one becomes invisible." She lifted her eyes then and looked at him. He was looking straight ahead at the path. He did not look angry. He looked tired, in the way of a man who has seen the same trick played on him many times. "You are not invisible, Miss Hartwell," he said. "I want you to know that I do not believe you are. That is a kind thing to say, Your Grace." "It is not a kind thing. It is only a true one." They walked the rest of the path without speaking. The bee came back. A bird called from the apple tree at the end of the garden. When they reached the gate, he turned and bowed to her, and she curtsied, and he went away without coming inside again. That evening, at supper, Petra did not speak at all. Their mother spoke too much. Their father read a letter at the table and pretended not to notice anything. 2 weeks passed. The Duke called 4 more times. Twice he found Vivienne at home. Once he met her by chance in the village, where she had gone to buy ribbon for her mother, and he walked her back to the house carrying her small parcel, as if he had nothing else in the world to do. Once he came when she had gone to visit a sick tenant, and he sat for 30 minutes with her mother and Petra, and drank tea and asked, when at last he rose to go, when Miss Vivienne might be expected back. Each time he came, Petra was kinder to him and colder to Vivienne. The coldness came out in small ways. A door not held. a seat taken at the dressing table when Vivienne had been there first. A ribbon Vivienne had set out for the next day, found in the morning to be tied around Petra's hair. In the second week, on a Wednesday, the family was invited to a card party at the home of Lady Daunt, who was their neighbour and a great friend of their mother. Lady Daunt had two unmarried daughters of her own, and a son who had just come down from Oxford, and her drawing rooms were always full. The Duke of Ashbourne would be there. Everyone knew the Duke of Ashbourne would be there. Lady Daunt had said his name three times in her note. Vivienne wore the green silk gown again. She wore it because she had no other gown that was suitable for an evening party, and because her mother had told her that morning, very gently, that they could not afford to have a new one made until the autumn. Petra wore a gown of pale yellow that had been delivered from London the day before. Vivienne helped her sister into it before she dressed herself, and she did the small buttons at the back with steady fingers, and she did not say anything when Petra turned and looked at the green silk and said, "Oh dear." That again. Lady Daunt's drawing room smelled of pine, because she kept fires of pine wood and of the strong sweet tea she served. The card tables had been set out in the larger of the two rooms, and the smaller had been kept open for those who wished to stand and talk. The Duke was already there when they arrived. He was standing near the fire, alone with a cup of tea in his hand. He saw them come in and he set the cup down at once, and he came toward them across the room. He bowed to Vivienne's mother. He bowed to Petra. He took Vivienne's hand and bowed over it. Then he said, very quietly so that only Vivienne could hear, "You wore it again." "I did," she said. "Good," he said. He let go of her hand and turned to her mother and made some polite remark about the weather. Petra stood very still in her pale yellow gown. Cards were played. Vivienne played at a table with three older ladies and lost a small sum at whist, which she could afford because the stakes were tiny. Petra played at a different table, with the Duke and with Lady Daunt's son, and with a young woman called Miss Bray, who was the daughter of a baronet and who laughed often. The Duke played politely. He won and lost in turn. He spoke only when spoken to. After cards, the company moved into the smaller room for refreshments. There were cakes on a long table, and tea, and a punch of warm wine. Vivienne took a small piece of seed cake and stood near the window. The window was open a little, and the air that came in was cool and smelled of cut grass. She did not see Petra approach her. She felt the touch first, a small hand on her arm, and then she felt the punch. It happened very quickly. Petra had been carrying a glass of the warm red wine punch, and as she came up to Vivienne, her hand jerked, and the whole glass went down the front of the green silk gown. The red spread across the soft green like an opened flower. It soaked through to her skin at once, warm and sticky and sweet-smelling. "Oh," Petra cried, very loudly. "Oh, Vivienne, I am so sorry. How clumsy of me. Oh, your gown." The room stopped. Every face turned. Lady Daunt set down her cup. The Duke, standing across the room near the long table, turned slowly. Petra had her hand over her mouth. Her eyes were wide and her cheeks were pink, and to anyone who did not know her, she looked truly distressed. But Vivienne knew her. Vivienne had watched her practice that exact face in the glass when they were children, and Vivienne saw also the small smile under the hand over the mouth. "I am so sorry," Petra said again. She said it loud enough for the room. "It is such an old gown, dearest. Perhaps it is for the best. Perhaps Mama will let you have a new one now." It was the cruelty of the word dearest that did it. Petra had not called her dearest in private for 10 years. She used it only in front of others, only when she wished to be seen as kind, and Vivienne had borne it many times. But the word, said now in front of this room, with the wine running down the silk that had been Petra's first and was now Vivienne's only, was a precise and quiet blow. Vivienne did not cry. She did not raise her voice. She did not look at Petra at all. She looked down at the wide red stain on the soft green silk for the count of 2 slow breaths. Then she looked up. She looked at Lady Daunt. "I beg your pardon, Lady Daunt," she said. Her voice was steady. "I have ruined your floor. "May I trouble a servant for a cloth, and then I will not trouble you further this evening." "My dear child," Lady Daunt began. "You are very kind," Vivienne said. "I am quite well. It is only a gown." She did not look at her mother. She did not look at the Duke. She walked across the room to the door, slowly, the way she had been taught to walk when she was 9, and Petra had pinched her in church, and she had been told that a lady never showed she had been pinched. The red punch dripped onto Lady Daunt's polished floor with each step. She did not stop. She did not look back. She walked through the front hall. The footman opened the door for her without being asked. She walked out into the cool evening air. The Daunt's gravel drive was long, and at the end of it was the road, and beyond the road was the lane that led to her father's house, 2 miles away. She did not have a carriage. They had come in her mother's carriage, and she could not ask for the carriage now without going back. She did not go back. She walked. She walked down the gravel drive. The sun had set, and the sky was the color of dark blue water with a thin gold line at the edge. The air was cool against her wet skin where the punch had soaked through. Her shoes were thin slippers, made for a drawing room floor, and the gravel pressed up through the soles. She felt every small stone. When she reached the road, she stopped for the first time, and she pressed her hand flat against the stone wall at the side of the drive. The stone was cold and rough. She closed her eyes. She did not cry. She breathed in once, slowly, and then she breathed out. The smell of the punch came up from her gown, sweet and warm and sickly. She could smell her own skin under it. She thought, very simply, that she had been a fool to think any of it would be different. She had been a fool to wear the gown twice. She had been a fool to walk in the garden with him. She had been a fool to count candles. She took her hand off the wall. She kept walking. It was almost a mile before she heard the horse behind her. She did not look back at first. The sound of hooves on the lane was not unusual. People rode along this lane at all hours. But the horse came up quickly, faster than was polite, and it came up directly behind her. And then it slowed. She turned. The Duke of Ashbourne was on a tall black horse. He had no hat. His coat was open. He had ridden out without changing anything, and his face in the last of the daylight was set in lines she had not seen on it before. He swung down from the horse. He did not tie it to anything. He let the reins fall, and the horse stood where it was. "Miss Hartwell," he said. "Your Grace," she said. He came to her. He stopped a pace away. He looked down at the gown. He looked back up at her face. "You should not have walked," he said. "I did not wish to be in that room any longer. I should have brought you in my carriage. You did not bring me. I was not yours to bring." He was very still. The horse, behind him, lowered its great dark head and blew warm air through its nose. Somewhere in the field beyond the wall, a sheep bleated once. "Let me take you home now," he said. "I will walk." "Miss Hartwell, Your Grace, please." Her voice was steady, but only just. "I would be glad of your kindness another day. I cannot be glad of it now. If you stand on this road with me, every person who passes will see, and tomorrow my sister will hear of it, and it will all be worse. Please, let me walk." He did not move. He looked at her for a long moment. The sky had darkened further, and his face was half in shadow. "I am not leaving you to walk alone in the dark," he said. "If you will not ride, I will walk with you. The horse will follow. I asked you to go. I heard you ask. And?" "And I am not going." She stared at him. He was not angry. He was not stern. He was simply standing there in the road with his coat open and the rein of the horse hanging from one hand, looking at her as if he had thought about this carefully on the ride out and had decided what he was going to do and was now doing it. She did not have the strength to argue. She turned and began to walk again. After a moment, she heard him fall into step behind her, the horse clopping quietly along behind him. They walked like that for perhaps a quarter mile. He did not try to come up beside her. He did not speak. He simply walked behind her at a respectful distance, with the horse, in the cool dark, while the smell of spilt wine rose off her gown and the gravel cut through her slippers. At the next stile, she stopped. Her right slipper had a hole in it now. She could feel the gravel against bare skin. She pressed her hand against the wooden post of the stile and stood there with her head bent. She heard him stop behind her. He did not come closer. "There is a stone in your shoe," he said after a moment. "There is a hole in my shoe." "Ah, Your Grace. Yes. Why did you come after me?" She did not turn to ask it. She kept her hand on the post and her face toward the wood. The wood smelled faintly of moss. "I did not come after you out of pity," he said. "If you thought that, I would like you to stop thinking it." "Then why?" He was silent for a long moment. The horse shifted on the gravel. "Because of how you walked out of that room," he said. "I have watched a great many people humiliated in my life. I have done it myself, when I was young and stupid. I have never seen anyone walk out of a room the way you walked out of that one. You did not look at anyone. You did not raise your voice. You took the punch, and you took the word your sister used, and you walked. And I sat there and I thought, that is the most dignified thing I have ever seen a person do. And then I thought, I am not going to let her walk home alone. She did not turn around. She closed her eyes. "You should go back," she said. "No, you will be missed. They will manage. My sister will say things. Your sister has said things already. She said one thing tonight that I will not forget for some time." She turned then. He was still standing where she had heard him stop, the horse behind him, his face half in shadow. He was looking at her steadily. "I am very tired, Your Grace," she said. "I know. I cannot speak with you tonight. I do not need you to speak with me. I will walk you to your gate. I will go away. You will go to bed. We will speak another day, if you will allow it." She did not have any answer to that. She turned and walked on. He followed. They walked the last mile in silence. When they came in sight of the lights of her father's house, he stopped at the bend in the lane. "I will go from here," he said. "You will not want me at your door tonight." "No. Good night, Miss Hartwell. Good night, Your Grace." She walked up the lane alone. When she looked back from the front step, he was still standing there in the road, holding the rein of his horse, watching her until she was inside. Petra was the one who opened the door. She had come home before Vivienne, by carriage. She was still in the pale yellow gown. Her face, when she saw Vivienne on the step, went through three changes very quickly: surprise, fright, and then, when she saw that Vivienne was alone, a small relief. "Where have you been?" Petra said. "Mama is in fits. She thought you had taken a fall." "I walked," Vivienne said. "In those shoes?" "In these shoes." Petra looked down at the ruined slippers. Then she looked up. "I did not mean for it to go down so much of the front," she said. It was the closest thing to an apology that Petra had ever offered her in their lives. Vivienne looked at her sister for a long second. Then she walked past her into the house. The next morning, Vivienne did not come down to breakfast. She told the maid she was unwell. She lay in her bed with the curtains drawn and stared at the ceiling. She had cried a little in the night, quietly into the pillow, so that no one would hear. She felt empty now. The green silk gown was in a heap on the floor where she had stepped out of it. She did not know what they would do with it. She did not care. Around 11 the maid came up and said that her mother wished to see her in the morning room. She dressed slowly. She put on the muslin with the blue flowers. She went down. Her mother was sitting at the small writing desk with a letter open in her hand. She looked up when Vivienne came in. Her face was strange. Vivienne could not read it. "The Duke of Ashbourne has written to your father," her mother said. Vivienne's hand went to the back of a chair. "He has asked to call this afternoon." "To call on Papa?" "To call on you. He has asked for a private interview." Vivienne sat down in the chair. She did not say anything for a long moment. "Has Papa replied?" "Your father has said yes." Her mother folded the letter. She looked at her younger daughter for a long time. Then she said something that Vivienne had not expected. "Your sister has gone to stay with your aunt in Bath," she said. "She left an hour ago. I sent her. I told her she would not be welcome at this house again until I was certain she could behave like a sister and not like a stranger. I should have done it years ago. I have been a poor mother to you, Vivienne, and I am sorry for it. Vivienne did not know what to say. Her mother had never used the word sorry to her in her life. I do not need an answer, her mother said. I needed to say it. Now go and put on something clean. Wear the muslin with the lace at the cuffs. He has seen you in plainer than that. But I will not have my daughter received in a duke's interview wearing a gown she cleans the parlour in. Vivienne went up the stairs slowly. She put on the muslin with the lace at the cuffs. She brushed her hair back and pinned it simply at her neck. She did not put on jewellery. She came back down and sat in the drawing room and waited. He came at 3 again. He was shown into the drawing room alone. Her father had retreated to his study. Her mother had retreated to the morning room. The door was left half open, as was proper, but no one was within earshot. He bowed to her. She rose and curtsied. He did not sit. He walked to the window and stood looking out at the small garden for a moment, with his back to her. Then he turned. "I have come to ask you to marry me," he said. She had thought she was prepared. She had not been prepared. She sat down again, slowly in the chair behind her. Her hands were in her lap. Her hands were shaking. She put one over the other to make them stop. "You have known me for 2 weeks, Your Grace," she said. 3 weeks tomorrow. That is not enough time. For what? For a man to know whether he wishes to marry a woman. It is enough time for me. Why? He came across the room then. He did not sit. He stood in front of her, close enough that she could smell the rain on his coat again, and the leather and the thing underneath that she still could not name. 3 weeks ago, he said, I had decided that I would marry a woman because she would be a competent mistress of my houses and a kind mother to my children and would not embarrass me in society. I had a short list of women who fit those things. Your sister was on it. I had not heard of you. She did not move. Then I went to Marchfield. I went deliberately. I went to look at Miss Petra Hartwell, who had been recommended to me by 3 different sources. I walked into that ballroom and I saw a young lady in a rose-pink gown laughing too loudly at 3 young men, and I saw, at the edge of the room, behind an orange tree, a young woman in a green gown that did not fit the fashion of this season, counting the candles. She had not known he had seen her counting before he crossed to her. She had thought he had only seen her standing. I watched you for a long time before I crossed the room, he said. Longer than was polite. I watched you watch your sister. I watched the way your face did not move. I watched you take a sip of lemon water that you did not want. I watched you go back to counting. And I thought to myself, that is a woman who has been overlooked for some time and has built herself a small private quietness inside it and does not need anyone to come and rescue her from it. And I thought, I have never wanted to speak to anyone more. He stopped. He looked down at his own hands for a second. Then he looked at her again. That was the first night, he said. Since then I have come to your house 6 times. I have walked with you in your garden and met you in the village and watched you handle your sister's small cruelties without ever returning them. I have seen you wear that green gown a second time when a less honest woman would have pretended she was ill rather than be seen in it. I have seen you walk out of Lady Daunt's drawing room with red wine down the front of you and not look back, and I have walked behind your shoulder for a mile in the dark, and I have made up my mind. She found that she could not look at him. She looked at the floor. My sister, she said. Your sister is not part of this. She will be furious. She is in Bath, I am told. You know that. Your mother had her note carried over this morning, before I rode out. She wished me to know that her elder daughter had been removed from the situation. Vivienne pressed her hands harder together. Your Grace, she said, I am not the woman on your list. No, I am not a competent mistress of houses. I have run 1 small drawing room and a quiet garden. I do not know how to manage a great estate. You will learn. I will help. I am not a fashionable woman. I do not want a fashionable woman. I am tired of fashionable women. I am not even. She stopped. She tried again. I am not pretty in the way they say a duchess should be pretty. Petra is the pretty one. People will say you have chosen wrong. They will say it for years. He was silent. Then he knelt. He went down on one knee on her mother's rather worn carpet, in front of her chair, and he took her two shaking hands in his two warm ones, and he held them. "Miss Hartwell," he said. His voice was low and quite even. "I have stood in many rooms in my life. I have watched many women walk into them. There is not one of them I could not stop looking at last night when you were not even in the room. There is not one of them whose name I would say the way I said yours in that ballroom. The first moment I looked across that room and saw you behind the orange tree, I could not look away. I tried. I tried for nearly 10 minutes. I came to your village to look at the wrong sister, and I could not look away from you, and I have not been able to look away since." She was crying. She had not meant to. The tears were sliding down her face quietly, the way the wine had slid down the silk. "Say yes," he said, "or say no. But do not say it because you think your sister is the pretty one. She is not the one I see." "Yes," she said. It came out very small. Her hands tightened on his. "Yes," she said again louder. "Yes." He bent his head and pressed his forehead lightly against the back of her hands. Just for a moment, she felt his breath warm on her skin. Then he stood, and he drew her to her feet, and he did not kiss her, because the door was half open and her mother was a careful woman. But he stood holding both her hands, and he looked at her, and she looked at him, and neither of them looked away for what felt like a very long time. The clock on the mantel ticked. A bird called outside the window. Somewhere in the back of the house a kettle began to sing. The wedding was held 7 weeks later at the small parish church a mile from her father's house. She did not wear green. She wore a new gown, plain white muslin with a soft ribbon at the waist, made by the village dressmaker, because Vivienne would not be made over in London like a girl who had been someone else before. Her mother cried. Her father read his part of the prayer book in a steady voice. Petra was there, having returned from Bath the week before. And she stood very straight in a gown of pale grey and did not say a word during the whole service. Whether that was because she had grown up at last, or only because their mother had given her a hard look in the porch, Vivienne did not know. But Petra came to her after, in the church door, and took her hands and said, "I am sorry, Vivienne. Truly. For the gown. For all of it." And Vivienne, who had decided in the night that she would not carry the old anger into her new house, said, "Thank you, Petra," and kissed her sister on the cheek, and let it be. There was one small thing she learned, in the weeks before the wedding, that she had not known. The day after Lady Daunt's card party, the Duke had ridden himself, alone, to the cottage of an old widow on the edge of his estate, whose husband had been one of his father's stable hands many years ago. The widow had written him a letter the week before, asking only that her roof be looked at before winter. Three other letters from her had gone unanswered in the years before he came home. He rode out to her cottage that morning, before he wrote to her father about Vivienne, and he sat with the old woman for an hour and drank her bitter tea and walked the line of her broken roof with her, and he gave instructions to his steward that day to have the whole thing replaced before the first frost. He did not tell anyone he had done it. Vivienne learned of it 3 weeks later from the widow herself, when she went with the Duke's housekeeper to call on the cottagers and bring them small gifts of tea and sugar before her wedding. The old woman told her, with her hands on Vivienne's, that the new Duke was not like his father, who had let the place go to ruin. The old woman did not know that Vivienne was about to become the new Duke's wife. She thought she was a kind young lady from the village. And Vivienne, sitting on a hard chair by the cottage fire, with the smell of peat smoke and old wool around her, learned in that moment something about the man she was going to marry that he would never have told her himself. She did not mention it to him. She kept it. She thought of it sometimes, in the years that followed, when she was tired or when she was uncertain. It was a small private thing, like counting candles, and it belonged to her. A year later, on a soft afternoon in early autumn, Vivienne sat in the long gallery of Ashbourne House with a piece of mending in her lap and the sun coming through the tall windows in warm yellow bars across the polished floor. The house smelled of beeswax and apples, because the cook had been making apple preserve all morning, and of wood smoke from the fire that had been lit in the small parlour at the end of the gallery against the first cold of the season. Vivienne wore a gown of soft grey wool, simple, made well. Her hair was tied back with a green ribbon, because she had grown fond of the colour since she had stopped having to wear it. There was a small low table in front of her, and on the table was a porcelain cup of tea that had cooled too far to drink, and a book she was not reading, and a small painted fan that she did not need, but liked to keep near her hand. The mending in her lap was one of her husband's shirts. He had torn the cuff on a nail in the stables, and the housekeeper had wanted to give it to the seamstress. But Vivienne had asked, quietly, if she might do it herself. The housekeeper, who had been with the family for 30 years, and had been doubtful of the new duchess at first, had brought the shirt up with her own hands. The door at the far end of the gallery opened. Vivienne did not look up at once. She knew the sound of his step. He had been out on the estate since breakfast, and she could hear, from the slight drag at the end of each stride, that his right boot was wet. "You walk through the brook again," she said, without raising her eyes from the cuff. "I did. The bridge is not so very far. The bridge is half a mile out of my way." He came down the long gallery. He stopped beside her chair. He did not sit. He set one warm hand on the back of her neck, where the small hairs lay loose under the green ribbon, and he stood there for a moment without speaking. She finished the stitch. She set the needle in the little pincushion on the table beside her. She lifted her face. "Your boot is leaving a mark on the floor," she said. "I am sorry. You are not." "No, I am not." He bent his head and kissed her, very briefly on the top of her head, where the ribbon was tied. Then he straightened. "There is a letter from your sister," he said. "Her husband has been promoted in his regiment. They are to be sent to York. That will please her. She has wanted to leave Bath for some time. I thought we might invite them for Christmas, before they go north." She looked up at him. He was looking down at the cuff in her lap with the small neat stitches all in a row. "Are you sure?" she said. "I am sure if you are sure." "I am sure." "Then I will write to her tomorrow." He moved away from her chair, toward the fire. He stood with his hands clasped behind his back and looked into the flames. The light moved gently on the line of his shoulder. Vivienne watched him for a moment. Then she picked up her needle again and made the next stitch in the cuff, and the next, while the house creaked softly around them in the autumn quiet, and the smell of apples drifted in from the kitchens, and somewhere far below in the courtyard a young groom whistled a tune that neither of them knew. She had not counted a candle in over a year. She had not needed to. Thank you for staying with this story until the very end. If this moved you, please like, share, and subscribe. Your support keeps these stories alive.